Great. Well, good to see everybody. This is a very interesting topic to me, and I guess it's interesting to you too, how there is a relationship in our experience between God and our genetics. I didn't realize when I put this presentation together that it was Halloween on the day I was speaking, so Ghost in the Genes has absolutely nothing to do with the fact that today is Halloween. Someone just pointed that out to me today. They said, oh, did you plan that? I said, no, I didn't even think about that. So that's purely a coincidence. And I thought since this is a CV, I should mention financial disclosures. Nothing pertinent to what we're talking about today. So here's the objectives I'd like to talk about today. Number one, there's a lot of quotes that we'll look at, some in the Bible, some in the Spirit of Prophecy, that, and also in the popular press, that have a lot to say about the relationship between our genetic inheritance and our behavior. Now, it's kind of intuitive for us to think of genetics and physical characteristics, like eye color and height and those types of things. We don't always think as intuitively about things like our genetic heritage. But it's not as intuitive for us to think about how genes influence our behavior and less commonly understood how our behavior influences our genes. And that's just been something that's fascinated me as I've kind of moved through my undergraduate, graduate, and professional career. Just kind of, it's not my area of work, but it's just something I've been collecting information about over time. So we're going to look at some statements from the Bible, the Spirit of Prophecy, and popular press about that. Then we want to understand where current research kind of gives us light on this, and does the current literature kind of support the position of the Bible and the position of the Spirit of Prophecy in regards to these issues relating to behavior, moral choice, and inheritance, which we'll define as used to be just genetics, but now we have the whole epigenetics category that we're going to talk about a little bit today, too. Zeno's going to spend a lot more time on this afterwards, so I didn't want to steal his thunder, so I'm just going to touch on this. My emphasis is more whether it's epigenetic or it's genetic, it occurs, whereas Zeno's going to spend more time just on the epigenetics. And then I want us to understand, no matter what is occurring in our experience influencing our behavior and our choices, the incarnation and life of Jesus gives us really strong example and a strong encouragement for whatever we're struggling with, God can bring us through that experience. Genetics is not our destiny. It's not our determination. It's just an influence in our experience. And there's a lot of things going on in the popular press that's saying, oh, if it's in your genes, you're stuck. And don't even try and change it. Don't even think about changing it. But I think we'll see from the evidence and certainly from the life of Christ that that's not necessarily the case. So now here's a verse that I used to kind of think about. It's in the Ten Commandments, both in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5 and a couple other places. The Lord is long-suffering and abundant in mercy, forgiving iniquity and transgression, but he by no means clears the guilty. And there's this phrase, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations. And you've probably kind of looked at that and go, well, that doesn't quite fit my picture of God. It seems a little arbitrary and unjust, if that's what it's saying, that God would hold the behavior of a grandparent or great-grandparent against the offspring three and four generations down the road. So that seems like a little bit of an unusual statement that as a young college, I say, well, what does that mean and what's being communicated to us there? Is it, in fact, God being unjust? Or is there something else going on that God's communicating to us? You see something similar to that in Psalms. The wicked are estranged from the womb. They go astray from birth. So again, we're seeing here the Bible communicating to us something about not just when we're born, but even before we're born, there's influences that are brought to bear, not just on our eye color and our height and those kind of things, but on our moral makeup. If you want to do an interesting study, there's a whole field of literature called moral babies or moral infants. I'll show you a book later that addresses that if that's something you want to study. But infants are not these kind of nebulous blobs who really have no decision-making processes, no perceptual powers until maybe 2 years old. They've shown quite well from 3 to 6 months of age that babies are already making moral decisions. They're differentiating between what's good and what's bad, what's right and what's wrong. The way they do this is, and we won't spend much time on this, the way they do this is they just take babies, and the way you can watch what babies like are, number one, what they spend the most time looking at. So the more time a baby spends gazing at something, the more he likes it. And number two, if you present him with options, what he reaches for is what he's attracted to. So they'll do experiments, and again, I'm not going to spend too much time on this, where they'll show little babies a puppet show. And again, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. And in the puppet show, there'll be two of the puppets interacting, playing ball perhaps. And then a third puppet will come into the scene, and he'll take the ball and run off the stage. Okay. Then what they'll do is they'll present those three puppets to the infant and see which one they reach for. And they almost never reach for the one that took the ball away. They always reach, almost always reach for the one that was playing ball. Another way they do this is they'll have three puppets, and they'll have a puppet pushing a ball up a hill, up a little slope. And they'll have one puppet come in that helps that little puppet push the ball up the hill, and they'll have another puppet comes, and he pushes the ball back down, making it hard for the first puppet to push the ball up the hill. And then again, they'll present those three puppets to the infant, and they'll almost always reach for the one that was helping the one up the hill. So they're differentiating at a very, very young age, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, that something good's happening here and something bad is happening there. They can't speak, but they're perceiving good and evil at a young age. Now, clearly in that setting, they're not born tabula rasa as a blank slate. There's something hardwired into their perceptual and understanding. They're perceiving that's good and that's not good. And the Bible is alluding to this here, not in the positive sense, but in the negative sense. Now, our atheistic friends kind of look at this and they go, "Oh, yeah, that seems a little odd. What's going on there?" So here's Christopher Hitchens. You've seen the book probably, God is Not Great. He says this, and he's referring specifically to the second commandment there in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy chapter 5. He says, "This is a dire warning that the sins of the fathers will be visited on their children, even unto the third and fourth generation." Then here's his assessment of what's being communicated here. This idea that God's visiting iniquity on the third and fourth generation, negates the moral and reasonable idea that children are innocent of their parents' offenses. Right? That's a reasonable idea, right? Kids are not morally responsible for their parents' mistakes, but his perception is that God's holding them guilty of this. Now, look at the next one here. Just look at the title of the book for a second. So, God Hates You, Hate Him Back, Making Sense of the Bible. So what Mr. Wuerlemann basically did is he's gone through the whole Bible. Now, he's read the whole Bible. So that's something to be said for that. He's read the whole Bible. He basically goes through passage by passage and picks out the things that seem a little hard to understand, a little bit odd, and then puts them together in this whole book with all these different things that he thinks are really a problem in the Bible. Anyway, regarding the second commandment, he says this. Interesting is the second commandment in which God promises to condemn up to four generations of a sinner's descendants, and further suggests that no matter how righteous your Judeo-Christian life should be, this will matter for naught if your great-great-grandfather believed in a sun god and you are thus surely doomed. And again, you can see just a literal reading, not really processing the Bible as a whole, why they might take that message away from things. Now, Ellen White says some very similar things about the hereditary nature of our moral experience. There are many who claim to serve God but who have no experimental knowledge of Him. They have not a personal relation with the living Savior, and their characters reveal defects, both hereditary and cultivated. Now, you and I are pretty familiar with cultivated defects, right? We've all done things that we wish we hadn't done and formed habits that we wish we hadn't formed. So we're very familiar with cultivated habits of character. But she's not just saying that we cultivate defects of character. We inherit defects of character, right? Now, what is character when you think about that? Well, another place she says, thoughts and feelings combined make up moral character. So we're inheriting patterns of thinking and patterns of feeling that reveal themselves in how we relate to each other. This is what she's articulating here. Those who put their trust in Christ are not to be enslaved by any hereditary or cultivated habit or tendency, hereditary tendency. Whatever may be your inherited or cultivated tendencies to wrong, we can overcome through the power that He is ready to impart. So again, tendencies to wrong. Again, a tendency is a behavior, right? We think a lot about health issues, which is an important thing to talk about, and the health issues related to genetics. We don't always process as much the moral dimension of heritability. And that's what we're going to look at a little bit more today. There is every phase of character received by children as an inheritance. Human judgment and ideas of the most experienced are liable to be imperfect and faulty, subject to their own hereditary traits of character. A quick temper can be transmitted. Children inherit inclinations to wrong. They have an inherited appetite for stimulants. So again, and if you just want to do a fascinating search, just in her writings, do hereditary or inherit. Remember to put the little star at the end so you get all the versions of that. There are several hundred statements, if you take out all the redundancies, where she talks about the heritability, the inherited characteristics that come along with the moral fabric of our being. Now, popular press has picked up on this, and these are just some I've collected over the years. So here's the Wall Street Journal, Blame It on Your Mom, Roots of Adult Diseases Traced Back to the Womb, Newsweek, sins of the grandfathers, okay, and that's almost a straight quote there from Exodus chapter 20. What happens in Vegas, there's that, they're making a play on that phrase, what happens in Rome, or what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens in Vegas, though, could affect your offspring, how early life experiences could cause permanent changes in sperm and eggs. Another Newsweek, born to be bad, genetic research says maybe argumentative parents pass on behavior problems to kids. Now, here's one, another one in Newsweek, why the young kill. There's every so often in the news, in fact, we just have in a couple weeks, a kid at school will do something and shoot a bunch of his classmates, right? Of course, well, why? We ask, why does that happen? Is it the video games? Is it the movies? Is it the music he listens to? Is it the friends he hangs out with? And those may and probably are all factors, but there's probably another factor, and they point that out there. Is there a predisposition to violence that some people are born with? Now, here's a one that's, I think, very pertinent to us as we relate to people. A survey of identical twins links biological factors with being gay. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this issue particularly, but I think as we go through our time together, you'll see that whatever behavior we're talking about, homosexuality is a behavior. Whatever behavior you're talking about, whether it's I shouldn't even say whether, because behavior is both rooted in our environment and in our heredity, we have the privilege of overcoming it. Now, here's a promise that goes along with that. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 10 talks about homosexuality, talks about being effeminate, those kinds of things. And then this is the promise that's encouragement to us. Such were some of you. So in the early Christian church, there were people who had same-sex attraction and struggled with that. It was part of their culture too. But Paul didn't say, you know, you're stuck with your heredity, you're stuck with your environment. He said, such were some of you, but you were washed, you were sanctified, you're justified in the name of the Lord Jesus. So no matter what the behavior is, by the end of our time together, we're going to see that God has the power to deliver us from that experience. Now, my wife is really afraid of mice and gets very nervous when mice are not just in the room or in the house or in the property, but if they're in the picture. So I put this in for her so she can look away and her sister can look away because here's some mice coming, a picture of a mouse. So here's another one from Newsweek. The mouse that roared and killed and raped due to a genetic defect. And even our good friends at NAJM, which all of us subscribe to, is our behavior written in our genes. So we're seeing here that the Bible, the spirit of prophecy, and popular perceptions are all kind of lining up that there's some reality to a genetic component to our behavior. And that's what we want to spend some of our time looking at today. Now, if you go back and just kind of look at this issue a little bit, there's been a lot of kind of, I'll call them genetic conundrums that pop up in our understanding. It's like, well why is such and such that way? And Prader-Willi syndrome, Angelman syndrome are kind of like that. When people, if you look at people with Prader-Willi syndrome and Angelman syndrome, they have the exact same genetic defect on chromosome 15. But they're very, very different pathologies, very, very different problems. So why would you have the exact same genetic defect on the same chromosome at the same spot and have these very diverse problems? Well, at the time, it was a conundrum they didn't really figure it out, but we come to know now that if you inherit the defect from your father's side, that exact defect on chromosome 15, you get Prader-Willi syndrome. If you inherit that exact same genetic defect on the chromosome from the mom, number 15 at that same spot, you get Angelman syndrome. Well, that was kind of a conundrum. Why would that be? And we didn't really understand that. And I'm not going to go into the details of how that works today. We don't have time for that. But this is just one example of these things that were coming up and people were present. Well, how does that work and why is that? Now, another problem that came up is we're all very comfortable with the identical twins are very similar, right? But geneticists and behaviorists ask, well, that's true, but they're actually very different. And if their DNA is exactly the same, 100%, why are they so different? And we don't really tend to ask that question, but identical twins are very, very different. And we'll look at some evidence that brings that out in just a minute. But you can kind of begin to process this just a little bit. Every cell in your body is an identical twin to every other cell in your body. Right? Every cell in your body is all identical twin. But look at how diverse they are. You've got some cells that are a couple feet long, like your neurons. You've got other cells in your liver, and your skin, and your brain. All different, but they're all identical twins. Right? So why? What goes on to make all these identical twins different? And why are adult identical twins so different? Well, here's just one of a couple of examples we'll look at. This is a fairly standard kind of way things that look. If you look at schizophrenia, and this is a table for schizophrenia, and it just from top to bottom, it's a gradient of genetic similarity. So at the top is just general population. So general population, 1% of people have schizophrenia. Identical twins, the heritability is about 50%. Now let me just explain heritability real quick. When heritability is defined as 50%, it doesn't mean if my identical twin brother, which I don't have, has schizophrenia, I'm 50% likely to get it. That's not what heritability means. Heritability means that 50% of the variation in a population is due to genetic components. Okay, that's very, very different than saying you're 50% likely to have something. That makes sense. So heritability isn't how likely I am to get something if someone else like me has it. That's not what heritability is. Heritability is in a population, right, in this case of identical twins, if one has it, what percentage of the difference, the variation in the other one is due to genetic issues, right? So it's not a statement of likelihood. It's a statement of percentage of variance due to genetic components as opposed to other components, okay? So we're seeing here that, I mean, why wouldn't it be the case that twins have 100% concordance for this situation? It's clearly a genetic component because the more closely related you are, the greater the gradient between how likely you are to get it, but it's not 100%. And you can find very, very similar graphs for multiple sclerosis, bipolar disorder, lupus, and asthma, and really a lot of other diseases have a very, very similar profile to this. This is just representative. Here's some more twin studies. The graph up here, different psychological and psychiatric diagnoses, different substance abuse disorders. But again, you know, why would these be so different in twins? You know, why would anxiety only give you this much and schizophrenia give you this much and different substance abuse issues? Here's twin studies with different kinds of substance abuse. But notice that if you're in Denmark, you've got an 80% concordance for nicotine use. But if you're in Finland, it's only 30%. So again, this is communicating to us that there's a lot more that goes with heritability than just the DNA sequence of what's going on there. How many of you had Dr. Ask for lecture? Yeah. I kept his lecture notes because I was so fascinated what he was saying there. And he was, I remember studying his lecture and thinking like, wow, this kind of fits into that whole Exodus chapter 20, the sins of the fathers visiting the third and fourth generation. Identical twins have a 60% heritability rate for alcoholism. Fraternal twins, only 30%. Not really a surprise there. Sons of alcoholics' fathers have 4 times the risk of alcoholism, even if they're adopted at a very young age to another home. So you live in an alcoholic home, and you're adopted out at a very, very young age, you still have 4 times the likelihood of having alcoholism as it's styled who wasn't born from an alcoholic father. Sons of non-alcoholic fathers adopted into an alcoholic father's home have no increased risk of alcoholism. So again, there's clearly a lot going on here. There's many factors going on that we're not really always processing. Non-alcoholic sons of alcoholic fathers have multiple neurohumoral differences. I didn't list these all out because there's so many of them. But structurally in the brain and metabolically in the hormone system, all those kinds of things, sons of alcoholic parents have different experiences. Their brains are structured differently. Their neurohumoral responses to things are different, even though they're not in the home with that father from a very, very young age. So again, telling us that there's... Now, just think what's going on here for a second. A behavior of a parent who doesn't influence his child is influencing the neuroanatomy and the behavior of his child who's not even around, right? There's something being passed on that's not just affecting what he looks like, how tall he is, but it's affecting his behavior. It's affecting his anatomy, his biology. That's a powerful principle and brings a tremendous amount of responsibility to us as individuals and how we relate to others. Now, we're pretty familiar with the idea that, although we should be, that When we talk about genetic things, the genes aren't all DNA. In fact, if you look at a chromosome, only 50% of a chromosome is DNA. There's a lot of other stuff in a chromosome besides DNA. This is something that's shown here. So if you look at, maybe just for simplicity's sake, we'll start here. Here's chromosome number 3, and these are identical twins at 3 years old, and here's another set of identical twins at 50 years old. Now, these stains are showing similarity. Yellow means similarity. Red and greens means difference. Okay, so yellow means similar, and you can see here, at 3 years old, there's a lot of similarities. Okay, red and green means different. Okay, so here we are at 50 years old. Now, here's the same, again, not DNA. This is tagging for non-DNA-related factors in the chromosomes. There's a lot of non-DNA-related differences between 50-year-old twins. So something has changed over those 47 years, not in their DNA, right? The DNA is still the same, but the non-DNA components of their chromosomes have changed a lot in those 47 years. So while their DNA is the same, they're very different people than they were 47 years ago. And that's true for really across the whole spectrum of the chromosomes. This is just the same thing. Again, these are the 50-year-olds. These are the 3-year-olds. And again, a lot of yellow here and a lot of red and green here. Still some yellow, but a lot of red and green. Well, what else is going on there then? Well, there's a whole area called epigenetics. And Dr. Zeno Charles Marcel is going to talk about that somewhere afterwards, but I'll just give you a few little introductions to that. Now, here we are with what we're kind of familiar with, right? Kind of come with, here's a DNA strand, and that's where the information is stored at, all right? Well, again, there's a lot more to a chromosome than DNA. So we have these other things on here called histone proteins and different kinds of markers and things like that. So this begins to organize this strand into what we call chromatin, all right? So these histone proteins begin to kind of wrap up and fold the DNA into more of an organized structure. Well, now we're going to add a few little epigenetic markers. We've got some DNA methylation here, these little M's. Histone methylation, histone acetylation, okay? There's other ones too, RNA transcripts, microRNA, sRNA. Prions are actually an epigenetic marker. A prion is what? It's a protein, right? And how does it work? It works by just binding onto your DNA. It's not changing the DNA sequence. It's just binding to the DNA and changing the expression of certain genes in the DNA. So a prion is a form of an epigenetic marker. So if you look at this, we've got this organization of DNA. And as we add these markers, we get varying degrees of condensation of the DNA into a denser package. Okay, and this is right on the table here. So you have euchromatin, which is this kind of uncondensed DNA with all of its other non-DNA components. And you have heterochromatin, which is this kind of packaged up DNA. Now, when it's open, when this is euchromatin, it's kind of open like this, that's when the genes are expressed or active. When you pack it up like this, genes are repressed or silent. The enzymes necessary to make the RNA and then the proteins that result from DNA, they can't get in here and do their work unless it's opened up like this. And it's all these little markers that open up the DNA and tell it when to start processing a certain gene or when to not process a certain gene. So if you have hypomethylation, in other words, less of these methyl groups, what's going to happen? You're going to have expressed or active genes. If I hypermethylate a gene, meaning I put a lot of methyls on there, it's going to make it more condensed like this, more repressed and silent. It's inaccessible because it's condensed and closed. Does that make sense? I'm going quickly just because I want to move on to some other things. So again, just to reiterate, as these things are occurring, they're part of the control mechanism for what's going to be expressed in the DNA. And we're going to see that these things are quite variable about how they can be taken on and lifted off during the course of a person's life and experience. All right, some more mouse are ahead. So look away if this is traumatic for you. Now, these are both identical twins. Now, the outfits are different. Outfits are different. But this is identical. The weight's similar here. Weight's different here. These are called... But these are identical twins, okay? These are called agouti mice. Anybody ever heard of agouti mice? So an agouti mice is an inbred genetically... These are identical twins. So what they do is they take a brother and a sister from a litter, okay? They mate them together. Okay, they have a litter. They take a brother and sister, they mate them together. They do that for about 20 generations, and you have a genetically identical strain of mice. okay? Because you've bred out all the differences by continuing to inbreed over generations. Well, then these particular mice, you can just kind of do something to them at one spot and get one variation. These are called agouti mice because they have a gene called the agouti gene. It makes a protein. But this is an interesting gene because it has what we call a pleiotropic effect, meaning one gene that has seemingly diverse effects. Okay, it's pleiotropic. It's multiple faceted. Now, in the mouse, in this agouti mice, it turns out that what it does is two things. Number one, it affects hair color, which is nice because now we can see what the difference in the phenotype is. But the other thing is, it also makes these mice prone to diabetes, to overeating and obesity, to certain types of cancers. So you have this one gene that controls hair color, but pleiotropically, it also controls obesity, diabetes, and cancer types of things. So it's a nice mouse model to study, and you can turn this agouti gene off and on just by working on that one little gene sequence there. All right, so just to reiterate this again, you got your agouti mouse, and you've got this little control region. We call it a transposon or an activator, those kinds of things. Now, if you methylate, remember we looked at those little methyl groups a couple slides ago. If you methylate this spot, the agouti RNA is only made very briefly in fetal development, and it's not made after that. And you get a healthy brown mouse with fur because that agouti gene can't produce its protein that has all these multiple effects. Now, on the other hand, if you don't methylate starter region, the activator region for this agouti gene, the whole life of the mouse is producing this agouti protein, and what you end up is a yellow-furred mouse that develops obesity and diabetes during adulthood, just off that one little spot. And the control mechanism is right here on this methylation of this one little area at the beginning of the agouti gene, this one little activator region. Now, it's not an all-or-none phenomenon. Like most things, there's a spectrum here. So you got your completely producing agouti gene mouse. Then you add a little bit of a methyl group, and you get kind of a mostly tan mouse with a little bit of brown. You add some more, and they get more dark. And you add some more methyl groups, and you get basically a nice dark mouse who is a very thin, healthy-looking mouse. And you'll get this whole spectrum of mice depending on how methylated their agouti genes are, this whole spectrum here. Okay. Now, interestingly, we can take a mother of these agouti mice, and just by giving them a certain diet starting just before conception, we can give them a diet that's fairly rich in methyl groups, and turns out this is onions, beets, soy products, things like that that are rich in methyl groups. And that mouse, when you give them that methyl-rich diet, they don't have babies just like them. They have these mostly normal agouti mice that don't have the methyl groups. They have the methyl groups attached. They're not producing that gene. If, on the other hand, you don't give them that methyl-rich diet, that's those little epigenetic markers are jumping on that gene, blocking its production, you get mostly the sicker mice. They're yellow. They're unhealthy. In that situation. So here's another diagram showing that. Methylated, it blocks the agouti gene, you get the nice, thin, healthy mouse. Not methylated, you get the obese, prone to cancer and diabetes mouse. And there he is. So we'll skip that for time's sake. Okay, so the point of that slide is just start from something fairly concrete that we're all familiar with. We're kind of familiar with health issues. We're kind of familiar with, you know, if you eat certain things, there's bad effects to it. But now I want to kind of shift a little bit to behavioral kinds of issues. Now, I don't know when you were growing up, like you'd get ready for church and your hair wasn't quite right. What would your mother do? Yeah, she'd lick her fingers and run it through your hair. There's something on your cheek. What would she do? She'd lick her fingers. And I thought that was kind of gross, didn't you? I thought that was kind of bad parenting. But if you're a mouse, that's good parenting. So a good mother mouse is a mother who licks and grooms her pups, gives them lots of space to suckle on her. That's a good mother mouse. Okay. Now, a bad mother mouse doesn't lick her pups, provides almost no contact. Okay? That's a good mouse mother and a bad mouse mother. Now, it turns out that if you're a good mouse mother, you raise a pup that is relaxed, has a high nurturing, and becomes a relaxed adult, responds to stressful situations and startling in a much more relaxed manner. If you have a bad mouse mother, raised an anxious, low-nurturing mother, you become an anxious adult. They startle very quickly. They have high cortisol levels. All sorts of things come along with being a bad mouse mother with your pups. Well, Now, we can actually say, like, well, you know, the reason that happens is because it's all genetic and bad mouse mothers have bad mouse puppies, and that's just because, you know, it's all genetic. Well, it turns out that if you take at birth the pups from the bad mother and have them over with the good mother, and vice versa, take the pups from the good mother and move them to the bad mother, you see the same things, right? So the pups that were born from the bad mother actually become good pups. They're more relaxed. They don't have the exaggerated startle response. And the same thing if you take the good pups from the good mother and put them under the care of a bad mother, one that doesn't lick them and groom them, then sure enough, those genes actually become highly methylated. And what happens is their hippocampus is smaller, and they're nervous. They have high cortisol levels. They startle very easy. They sit in the corner of the cage, that whole type of thing. So it's not the genes that the mother passes on. It has to do with the attention that the mother gives to the baby mouse. Okay, now, again, you always be careful in a presentation like this, like, oh, you know, my kid's acting up. I must not be a good mother. That's not the point of this, because we can show you the same stuff for fathers. There's all sorts of things that happen with the fatherhood, too. But this is just a good illustration of a principle that I want us to understand. Now, interestingly, if you take this bad mother mouse, the one who doesn't lick and groom, and then you inject the pups of hers in their brain, in the hippocampus region, with something called tricostatin A, which kind of knocks off the methyl groups off of some of these genes in the brain, you get these mice that are relaxed and comfortable and don't startle easy. So this methylation is actually reversible, and when you change that methylation pattern in the mouse's brain, what happens? You get a completely different mouse. He's more relaxed. He doesn't have the same high cortisol levels. All those kind of things occur. So what's that saying? Is that saying that there's a behavior that's causing not a genetic but an epigenetic change in the offspring, and that change is reversible, at least in this situation, through a medical intervention of some sort. So just to review this again then, a good mom is a high grooming licking of pups, has a larger hippocampus. And the reason I'm emphasizing this is because we're going to see the same thing in humans in a couple slides now. These pups have a larger hippocampus, less cortisol release with stress. They're calmer when startled. They have less methylation in the hippocampus neurons. The opposite of that is true for the ones that have low grooming or licking parents. Smaller hippocampus, more cortisol release, run to the corner of a cage when they're scared. They have more methylation in the hippocampus. Those are things we can measure. Okay, we'll skip that for time's sake. So here's one example. We'll develop this a little bit in the next few slides. Child stress hormone levels correlate with mother's socioeconomic status and depressive state. So here we're measuring salivary cortisol. And sure enough, as you would expect, if, you know, stress levels in all of us vary with socioeconomics. If we're struggling to get by, we have more stress in our lives. And that same cortisol, that same stress response is mirrored in our children. So here you can see if someone's from a high socioeconomic status, their kids have lower cortisol levels. If they're from medium or low socioeconomic status, especially as they get older, they have a higher cortisol level. This also correlates with a mother's depressive score. So if the mother's more depressed, the child's cortisol levels get high. Now, it's not a huge difference, 0.22, but it's very significant. So it may not be a dramatic rise, but it's highly significant if you fit the line for this curve there. So again, this is making the point that the mother's behavioral expressions are manifesting themselves in the offspring. Here's another example of this. So this one was an MRI study, and what they did was they looked at hippocampal size. The hippocampus is a very interesting organ of the brain. I won't spend too long on it, but the hippocampus is a place in the brain that's part of the limbic system that has a lot to do, we would think of a lot of times, with spatial understandings, those kinds of things. But it also has to do with, in people that have different kinds of psychiatric illnesses, such as schizophrenia, substance abuse, eating disorders, anxiety disorders, different kinds of mood disorders, the hippocampus tends to be smaller in those kinds of individuals. So it's kind of a marker for a lot of studies. They measure hippocampal volume and correlate that with different outcomes. So here's a child's depression score, low versus high, and a maternal support scale, and they have all sorts of metrics that they use to measure this. And then they see, well, how does that correlate with hippocampal volume? Well, if you have a very low depression score and a very high maternal support, you have a fairly normal-sized to good-sized hippocampus. If you have depression as a child and all sorts of causes for that, and you have low maternal support, you have a smaller hippocampus. Okay. And again, this is just making the point that, and then in between, the mother support mechanism, the maternal support correlates with hippocampus volume. So again, there's an influence being exerted by one person on another person. And that influence has an impact, not just on sort of this nebulous, emotional kind of thinking level. There's biology going on. There's biochemistry going on. When we relate to other people in a positive way, we're doing things positive to them. We're lowering their cortisol levels. We're, I don't know about enlarging, but we're enhancing the things that have their hippocampus be successful in their experience. When you relate to someone negatively, you cause other changes going on in their psyche. Their cortisol levels go up. That is all part of their their hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. And consequences occur from that. So we have the ability by how we relate to each other, whether it's parents to children, husbands to wives, siblings, people we meet at church and at work, to actually affect the neuroanatomy of what's going on in people's minds and experiences. Now, I'm going to just have one more study here because this is kind of puts it together in some ways for adults. So we know a few things. Maternal care influences, this is the hypothalamic pituitary axis that I was just mentioning. So maternal care influences that action, that cortisol loop in rats and non-human primates via epigenetic programming, where we looked at those methyl groups very quickly, of the glucocorticoid receptor expression. So just to say that again, we know that in rats and in non-human primates, when the maternal care, it influences how much glucocorticoid receptors are in their hippocampus. And that's if you have high glucocorticoid receptors in your hippocampus, in your hypothalamus, that means that there's not a lot of glucocorticoid or cortisol floating around. So that's kind of a marker for kind of a low stress, relaxed, comfortable kind of situation. And we know that maternal care influences that. In humans, childhood adversity and abuse and family function alters this same hypothalamic pituitary axis stress response. It increases suicide risk and other psychopathology. Now, in rodents, they've made that same correlation now between this glucocorticoid receptor and HPA activity associated with epigenetic activity. So what they've done in rodents is they've connected these molecular changes, the glucocorticoid levels, and this whole cortisol level interaction with methylation at the promoter region for cortisol production and glucocorticoid receptor expression in the brain. Now, the question is, can you make that same loop occur in humans? And the answer is yes. They've found these same methylation patterns going on in the hippocampuses of adults in humans. Well, how did they do that, you say? Well, they did something quite ingenious. They compared, for time's sake, I'll skip through this, they compared suicide victims with a history of child abuse with suicide victims with no history of child abuse. Okay? So the suicide's the same, right? They both died of suicide, and then they extracted parts of the brain after they were done. Then they measured glucocorticoid receptor levels in that hippocampal tissue, and they measured methylation on those DNA segments to see, is it the same thing like in the mouse where if you grow up in a home where there's childhood adversity abuse, and this is defined as sexual abuse, physical abuse, or emotional abuse, if you grow up in a home like that, does that actually affect not just one, your hippocampal size, which we saw on another slide, but can you actually trace that down to the DNA level where there's epigenetic changes occurring? Okay? Does that make sense, what they're trying to do? They're trying to say, does a behavior that I experienced, in this case child abuse, does that change the expression of certain genes in my brain? That's basically what's going on here. Okay? Does when I interact with someone else, does the way I relate to other people actually change what's going on in their brain and actually change what's going on in their genes? And that's just showing that the groups were well matched. And sure enough, here it is. So here's these glucocorticoid receptor levels. And there's a higher receptor level in the controls and the suicide non-abused than the suicide abused. It was quite statistically significant. So, and these are just two different markers for that. One's the messenger RNA and one's the actual receptor. But in both situations, so sure enough, the expression of that receptor is different based on the home you grew up in. If you grew up in a positive environment, your hippocampus is acting differently. You're experiencing life differently. And don't worry about this part right here, but if you just look here, this is the methylation of the tissue there in the hippocampus. And sure enough, there's less methylation in the control groups in the suicide non-abused than the suicide abused. Again, what is this telling us? It's just telling us that when you experience an environmental influence, okay, It's a real experience, and it's actually changing your neuroanatomy. It's changing how your genes are expressed. Okay? The sins of the fathers are being visited, right, to the third and fourth generation. What's happening? God's imposing some arbitrary penalty because he just likes to make people suffer down the road. And he wants you to know that if you don't act, if you're not good, he's going to really stick it to your grandkids. No, there's a reality behind this. God doesn't just move in and break up the reality of our experience. Now, what does Ezekiel chapter 18 tell us? It tells us that if the son does something different, right, he's going to experience a different outcome. So this doesn't mean that you're locked into a certain type of lifestyle, right, or a certain type of destiny. We can change that destiny. Okay, I'll skip that for time's sake. And I'm just going to zip through this last part because I only have about 10 minutes left. But again, this is just more information that correlates that. This one was actually prenatal exposure. They took cord blood from newborn babies and just noticed that the difference in DNA methylation patterns depending on the mother's anxiety and depression scores. So if a mother, when she's prenatally and natally having a lot of depression, anxiety, there's an increase in methylation on these receptors. So again, she's going, who knows what all going in her experience is causing her to be anxious and depressed, but that reality is passed on in some way to the DNA, not the DNA actually, but the epigenetics and the gene sequences and how they're activated in the offspring. And then that correlates with cortisol levels at 3 months. They checked that too. All right, so this is one of my concluding slides before I move to the third part. So we've got this genetic makeup, and then we've got this epigenetic modulation, and really, all sorts of things affect this. This isn't even exhaustive because the whole religious sphere is left out of here. Diet. We talked about the methyl-rich diet in the mouse, okay? And I think Dr. Charles Marcel is going to talk a bit more about this, but what you eat has a profound impact on your epigenetic makeup. Your circadian rhythms have an epigenetic component to them. You can look at epigenetic markers and their fluctuations during the day. Markers go on, markers go off, markers go on, markers go off. Menstrual cycles influenced by epigenetic markers. Certainly disease exposure, social interactions. That's what I was kind of trying to deal with a little bit today. The microbiome we talked about in the last session. Exercise, and I won't spend time on this, but exercise has a powerful influence on those epigenetic markers that you have. Now, I just want to, if you want to kind of process this a little bit more, this is one of the, I've read several books on this. This is the best one I've read, Genes and Behavior, Nature, Nurture, Interplay, Explain. I just want to read a couple of quotes from him to kind of pull this all together. Genetic influences operate in a probabilistic, not deterministic fashion. Okay? Now, this isn't a religious guy saying that, right? That sounds like Ellen White, right? Tendencies, probabilities, right? We're not determined by what our genes do. They have an influence on us. They increase our or decrease our probabilities, but they don't determine our outcomes. To an important extent, genes operate through environment. Any dispassionate but critical review of the research leads to the clear conclusion that there are substantial genetic and environmental effects on almost all types of behavior. That's the part I want you to take home with. Substantial genetic and environmental effects on almost all types of behavior. So it's never the right answer to say, really, with anything, that is it genetic or is it environmental? Almost everything, including behavior, is accommodating both of those factors. And that includes sexual behavior. And I put that in just for the same-sex attraction issue that's rising here. Our genetics is not our destiny. It's just an influence, right? So such were some of you. Paul said, you juggled all these different things, one of which was same-sex attraction. Such were some of you, but you were washed. You were cleansed. So this is something we can, and again, this isn't a religious guy, but he's saying all behaviors are not determinative based on just genetic influences. A main conclusion from quantitative genetic studies is that genes have an effect, sometimes greater, sometimes lesser, on virtually all aspects of behavior. Now this is important too. Experiences affect physiology. So what you process in life affects your physiology. Equally, however, experimentally induced or naturally occurring changes in the physiology will have emotional and behavioral consequences, right? Ellen White talks about the mind and the body interacting, right? When you experience things in life, there's a change going on. There's hormones being released. There's anatomy in your brain changing, right? And the same is true also. When you interact with your environment, things are changing, and the environment's changing you both ways. Well, the reality is, though, as you encounter patients on a day-to-day basis, it's interesting to know what the causes are, but they're going to say to you at the end of the day, listen, I don't know if it's my genetics, I don't know if it's my epigenetics, and I don't know if it's how I was raised, but I know I'm struggling. I know I have trouble getting over this. I know I can't change this. Okay? So at the end of the day, no matter how we process all of that and the reality that's going on, people are still going to struggle in certain areas, and we need to know how to deal with that. Now, Job had this same question. He says, speaking about God, God's not a man as I am, and there's no mediator between us that can lay his hand on us both. Basically, what's he saying? He says, God doesn't understand my experience. That's basically what he's saying. He's not a man as I am. He doesn't go through human experience like I do. He says, do you have eyes of flesh, or do you see as a man sees? Are you processing reality, God, like I'm processing reality? I don't think so. Your days aren't like the days of a mortal man. But God says, actually, I do process things like you do. I do see things like you do. Not because I'm all omniscient God, although he is, right? He can say to us with credibility, I understand by experience what you're going through. When the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law. What law is that? It's that same law we read about in Exodus chapter 20, right? The sins of the fathers being visited on the third and fourth generation. Jesus encountered that reality. The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all, right? It said what? It's visited on us. Exodus chapter 20, and it was laid on him. For time's sake, he accepted the result of the working of the great law of heredity. Here's the epigenetic or genetic heritage of Jesus. Okay? Again, remember, this is all tied into those factors that we just went through very, very quickly to show the DNA and the genetics, all that. But all these are things that Jesus had in his genetic and epigenetic experience. So he can say with us with credibility, I do see as you see. Now again, sometimes we think, yeah, God knows what we're going through because he's omniscient. Okay? Let me just give you one illustration. If you go to your oncologist and you have breast cancer, and he says, oh, you know what? I've treated thousands of breast cancer patients just like you. I know exactly what you're going through. Does that hold weight with you? Now, you could be sitting in your chemo chair, and right next to you is the person getting their last, they've only had breast cancer once, and they're getting the last chemo treatment, and they say to you, I know what you're going through. Who has more credibility, the one who's seen 1,000 breast cancers and treated 1,000 breast cancers, or the one who's gone through one breast cancer? It's the one who's gone through one breast cancer, right? It's the same with God. God can tell us all day, listen, I'm God. I know everything. I know what you're going through. But we would still say, really? So in order to convince us that he understands our experience, he did something very, very important. He came down and experienced reality like us. Not just the environment, but the genetic heritage that we all experience. I'm going to skip through this very quickly. Christ took upon him the infirmities of degenerate humanity. Christ must reach man where he was. He took human nature, bore the infirmities and degeneracy of the race. Our liability to sin was laid upon him. This just makes this point a little bit more. So I just want to finish with this. God understands by experience what we go through, not merely by observation. Angels are ever present where they are most needed. They are with those who have the hardest battles to fight, with those who must battle against inclination and hereditary tendencies, whose home surroundings are the most discouraging. Those who, through an intelligent understanding of the Scriptures, view the cross aright. Those who truly believe in Jesus have a sure foundation for their faith. They have that faith which works by love and purifies the soul from all its hereditary and cultivated imperfections. Now, didn't we just read this from the book Genes and Behavior by the secular author? He was saying the exact same thing. In scientific language, he's using theological language, but he's saying the exact same thing. A genuine conversion changes hereditary and cultivated tendencies to wrong. So how does that occur? Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares. Now that's a broad category, right? For some people it's same-sex attraction. For some people it's appetite. For some people it's temper. Some people it's substance abuse. But whatever the weight is and whatever the easily ensnaring sin is, we can run with endurance race before us. How do we do that? Looking to Jesus. looking to Jesus. He understands by experience, not merely by observation, what we go through. And if you want to pursue this a little bit more, I found nothing as good as Spirit of Prophecy, but this is that book I mentioned on moral infants, the moral dimension of infants. This is a book on epigenetics revolution. It's very, very good. And these are a couple of articles that I found very, very helpful that kind of summarize things within about 20 pages. So, good, we're good. 10 after we're done. Thank you.
This media was produced by Audioverse for Amen, Adventist Medical Evangelism Network. If you would like to learn more about Amen, please visit www.amensda.org. Or if you would like to listen to more free online sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.